Massachusetts, there is a 200-mile region where unexplained and sometimes sinister events occur. This region is known as the Bridgewater Triangle. It is widely believed that the reason for this hotspot of supernatural and mystifying activity is due to the way that English settlers treated Native Americans. You are listening to Small Town Mysteries, Bridgewater Triangle Edition, and we are your hosts, Kate,
Christine,
Rachel.
Listener discretion is advised. So, yeah, before I get kind of into my script, most of it's in the intro. It's a 200-square-mile region in southeastern Massachusetts, containing parts of multiple towns, the epicenter of which is Bridgewater, which is pretty close to us. We don't live in the Bridgewater Triangle, but we're very close. I know Rachel's family lives in the Bridgewater Triangle.
Do I? The thing is, I'm not 100% sure, because only, like, some of my town is covered.
Okay.
But potentially I could be in the Bridgewater Triangle right now.
I just remember that for Rachel's wedding, we camped in the backyard after, and all I could think about was that we were in the Bridgewater Triangle.
Middleborough isn't. No.
It's not?
It's not.
It's not?
Mm-mm.
Middleborough is a very old town, though, and it's also, like, made of bogs. So, like, there's a lot of history there with, like, workers and things like that.
I don't know if you guys read ahead in my script, but there is, like, a couple terms that, like, you'll recognize from, like, street names in Middleborough near Rachel's house.
Okay.
I'm looking right now, and it doesn't have, like, a list of the towns that are included. I guess they say 200 square miles, but I don't know how set the lines are.
Yeah, there's an actual triangle from what I've seen that's on a map.
Yeah.
And I think parts of some towns are included and parts of them are not.
Okay.
Well, I don't know how they determined that. I just know the term was coined by a person who wrote a book about it. So maybe he was the one that kind of defined the lines.
What was his name? Lauren something.
Yeah. But how did he? I don't know. I would be interested to know how exactly it was defined.
So this is what I found.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the book I read, which was, I really recommend. I'll talk more about it next week. But I read The Ghosts of the Bridgewater Triangle by Christopher Balzano. Oh, shit. Nope. Balzano. Christopher Balzano. And he said that the person who coined the term only included the Freetown Forest because of all the cult activity that was going on. So, like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me because I feel like Freetown Forest is like the epicenter, kind of. I feel like that's where a lot of the shit takes place. So I don't know. I'll look more into that and I'll tell you next week.
Okay. Yeah. Because I was wondering, like, what would the three points of the triangle be? And is it based on prominent locations that, you know, make up the boundary? And I don't think it is. I think the triangle term comes from the Bermuda Triangle pretty clearly. And they just made a triangle to go with it.
There's another triangle in New England that's like...
New Hampshire, isn't it?
Is it Bennington?
No, it's Vermont. Yeah, the Bennington Triangle.
Yeah. So it could also be named after that. I obviously don't know the history of which is first, but...
No, I have no idea which is first, but yeah. I have heard,
crazy shit about that.
So, moral of the story here, we actually have no idea what the legitimate boundaries of the Bridgewater Triangle is, because I'm not sure how much of that is, like, super legit and how much is... just people saying, yeah, it's this area. But it does encompass a lot of weird stuff. So, before I start, I want to just shout out the book that I used for a lot of my research. So helpful, and Rachel picked it up for me at the local library. Shout out to local libraries. Always start your research at your local library. Support your local library. I used to work at the library, I'm biased. So, the book is called Hockomock, Place Where the Spirits Dwell by Peter Tower. And it was good, straightforward read, tons of info. So this is only a snippet of what I found in there, because there was so much info, and I obviously supplemented it with other sources. So today I'm going to be talking about the Hockomock Swamp, which is not the central part of the Bridgewater Triangle. That would probably be the Freetown State Forest, would be the epicenter of a lot of the activity. But there's a lot that goes on in the Hockomock Swamp, and a lot of it is connected to the history of the triangle. So it's a really good starting place for a series that covers sort of all the little tiny pieces that make up the triangle.
Well, I feel like even like other places in the Bridgewater Triangle somehow refer back to like the Hockomock Swamp or the Wampanoags or something. Like, I have a lot of history in mind and I didn't even cover that. You know what I mean?
Right. It really is sort of the starting place of a lot of the lore that sort of led to the mythos of the Bridgewater Triangle. So Hockomock Swamp is a 6,000-acre conservation area encompassing portions of West Bridgewater, Bridgewater, Easton, Norton, Raynham, and Taunton. It encompasses a chunk of the Bridgewater Triangle, but not all of it. So it's kind of like rectangles and squares. All squares are rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares, which is just one of my favorite analogies to use. So I had to sneak that in there.
Honestly, Kate, that kind of surprises me that you would like an analogy like that, because you hate math and you hate shapes.
Who said I hate shapes? What are you talking about?
Was it you? I thought it was you who was saying there was no need for geometry.
I mean, I don't like geometry because I'm bad at it, but I don't hate it. I don't hate shapes.
That's such a weird hatred to have. Like, what?
I feel like that's like the villain on like a kid's TV show. It's like, yeah, that's Kate over there. She hates shapes. No, I don't hate shapes. The rectangle square comparison is one of my favorites. So all of the Hockomock Swamp is in the Bridgewater Triangle, but not all of the Bridgewater Triangle is in the Hockomock Swamp. There we go. And I'm a word nerd, so I have background on the name. So Hockomock is an Algonquin word that's usually interpreted colloquially as the place where spirits dwell. But if you break the word down to its root components, the meaning is a little bit different and a lot more eerie. So hawk translates to body and kamak is structure. So a rough translation of those components would be the place where bodies are on structures. As we dive into this weird, weird place, I know we're only in the first episode, the first couple minutes, that name's going to be super creepy. Because I know a lot of what's going to go on in this series. And the place where the bodies are on structures is, like, kind of on point. So, the land contained within the Hockomock Swamp and much of the Triangle, and frankly a good chunk of the entire South Shore of Massachusetts, is Wampanoag land. The term Wampanoag itself has a very straightforward meaning. It means Eastern or people of the dawn, as in people of the east where the sun rises. So that makes sense. The Wampanoag tribe is still active in Massachusetts and recognized as two groups, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead or Aquina, which is on Martha's Vineyard. There are a few other unrecognized Wampanoag tribes as well. And as we get closer to Thanksgiving, I also want to say that the vast majority of Americans, quite literally any American who isn't native, lives on stolen land and should acknowledge the tribes from which the land they live on was stolen. The version of Thanksgiving that is largely taught, especially to children, is so incredibly false. I really could go on about this, but I'm going to stop myself before I start rambling and just say, make sure you know what tribe your land was stolen from, especially as we approach the deeply sanitized version of Thanksgiving. Anyway.
Also consider what settlers did to all these people. Like, I think right. That's also something to really keep in mind. They not only just brutally murdered them, but they, like, tortured them,
mm-hmm.
did experimentation on them. So obviously there's going to be bad energy trapped in these lands.
Right. And so I get into that because a lot of the conflict that happened that led to these tribes being almost completely wiped out happened in the Hockomock Swamp or in and around it. So the Wampanoag tribe of antiquity, I think that's the right term, because as opposed to like the modern one, the tribe of antiquity, not positive on that. They worshipped 37 total gods, most of whom were minor gods related to various aspects of nature, such as trees and rain. But the two, I guess you could say, biggest gods are Cautantawil, who is their creator, and Hobomok, who was an evil deity of death and disease. Interesting name. Hob-amok.
Yeah.
Run amok. Sorry.
Well, I just think Hobomok is so close to Hockomock.
Hockomock.
I'm like, yeah, there's no coincidences here, obviously. So it's sort of difficult to comprehend for a lot of people who are raised in and may follow a monotheistic religion where there's just one god. But in polytheistic belief systems, it was important to worship all of the gods, even the evil ones. So it may sound like deeply counterintuitive to worship the god of death and disease, but the Wampanoag viewed their worship of Hobomok as an act of appeasement. Like, he would not bring death and disease to their communities if they worshipped him in the same way that they worshipped their creator god. So that's where a lot of the Christian notions of Native Americans being devil worshippers comes from, is just a fundamental misunderstanding of polytheistic religion. So then worshipping a deity of disease and death equates to what Christianity views as Satan. But really, it's not like that at all. This is a misguided understanding of Native American beliefs, but it forms the substantial basis for almost all, if not all, the conflict between Native American tribes and the European settlers and colonists. So the Wampanoag tribe, long before Europeans ever stepped foot near Plymouth Rock, like centuries, recorded odd apparitions that they thought were sent by Hobomok that were so terrifying that this tribe of literal warriors had a rule about not being outside after dark. Like, at all. That's how terrifying these apparitions were. The Wampanoag believed that Hobomok's powers were meted out by shamans, so like sort of Native American priests, who could use Hobomok's power to heal people. So the chiefs of the tribe often communed with these shamans to make important decisions. So Hobomok was like a really significant factor in military and other important decisions, especially once the pilgrims arrived and they had to make a lot of decisions about, like, you know, friend or foe, how do we fight back? Hobomok was sort of a guiding light. So the chief at that time was named Massasoit, and he relied heavily on what the shamans brought from their communications with Hobomok. He thought that was a really important source of his decision-making power, was to sort of take from directly what the gods were saying, and specifically from what Hobomok was saying for their military decisions. So going to get into King Philip's War now. So while Massasoit was chief, around the time that the pilgrims came to America, he brokered a number of sales, and I use that word generously, because I'm not sure how much actually was given in exchange, with the pilgrims of Wampanoag land, a lot of which became the towns that comprised the Bridgewater Triangle. Then in 1675, Massasoit's son, Metacomet, wanted to reclaim this land that had been sold. And again, I put that in air quotes because I just don't think there was much of an exchange of value going on here. And he wanted to use military force to reclaim this. He was probably of a similar mindset to where I am, which is like, this wasn't a sale, they took our land. Metacomet was known to the settlers as King Philip because white people have always historically had problems with names that weren't white enough for them. So that's why it's called King Philip's War. It wasn't an actual King Philip or anything. It was Metacomet, and they called him King Philip because white people. The series of military acts and the war that followed is known as King Philip's War. So depictions of this war in popular culture really emphasize the land possession aspect of the war. But there's a lot of historical evidence that indicates that the war was just as much based in religion as in land disputes. Remember, the Christians thought that the Native Americans were devil worshippers. And the lead general for the Wampanoag in King Philip's War was Tispaquin. And that was the one, that's a street near where Rachel lives. So that's, I was just reading through this. It was remarkable hearing a lot of these names in their historical context, because these are all like street names or the names of colleges. Like Massasoit is the community college in our area. So that's just an aside that so many names, the naming of so many areas is heavily influenced by these Native American histories as well. So Tispaquin specifically claimed to be influenced by Hobomok in making his military decisions. So he was both the lead general and a shaman. So he was taking directly from Hobomok in making his military decisions. And he was known as aggressive. He was known for his violence. So I think that's a bit of a reductive view of the entire situation, given that they were taking back their land, but alas. King Philip's War is known for having a higher percentage of death among both English and native populations than literally any other American war ever fought. It was a particularly brutal war, due in no small part to the fact that the English thought that they were literally fighting a war against the devil himself.
Also, like, I think it makes more sense, like, back then, because obviously you didn't know, like, other people, but I think it's, like, one of those things, if people are not like you, then, like, they're the enemy. Like, I don't really think it matters. I think it's just kind of one of those things of survival.
Right, different was wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So about 1/10 of all men available for military service, and that was for the English, were killed in the war, and 12 entire towns were actually completely destroyed in the crosshairs of this war and had to be rebuilt from the ground up. Hundreds of Wampanoag were enslaved or even executed by the English. And if you're wondering what happened to the white people, it was a really crucial moment for the English settlers in forging an independent identity from the European governments that had supported them. Meaning, they kind of had always been backed by the crown, and this was one of the first wars that they kind of fought on their own without that support from the British crown. So, kind of a big deal for them in forging their own identities. So yay for white people working together. I'm so happy for them. Is this really the cause to advance this? Not so sure. So that's a very basic outline of King Philip's War, because it would take me 5 episodes to cover it in any amount of detail. But what's super duper important to note is that the Wampanoag allegedly lost a sacred wampum belt during the course of this war. And some historians, and also like maybe cryptozoologists also, believe that it was the loss of this belt that led to all the weird shit happening in the swamp and in the Greater Bridgewater Triangle today. So people are theorizing that if the belt were to be returned to the Bridgewater Triangle, some of the more nefarious activity would cease. Who knows?
Is there any record of where this belt could be, or is this just like a legend?
It's just legend. There's no record of it.
Okay.
It's not like one of those things where it's like in a museum in another state, so we know exactly where it is and it can be returned and just hasn't been. It's like no one actually knows where it is with any specificity. And also notice that I said that they allegedly lost it. Even that, the fact that it was like lost is up for contention. Historians have differing views on that. So I'm going to talk now about really important rocks that are in the Hockomock Swamp. And don't laugh, because these rocks are like super important and they're actually really interesting. So don't come at me for getting a little excited to talk about rocks. I'm not a geologist, but these rocks in particular are very cool. And I have pictures on the dock, so you guys are both in the dock right now. So I encourage you to scroll down to look at some of these rocks. First up is Profile Rock, and here's a picture of it. And this is when you say, wow, yeah, that is a profile of a man.
It does look like a profile,
it really
yeah.
Does.
Like,
it
exactly.
Is.
I feel like it also really looks like a profile of a Native American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good observation. So as you may have gathered from the name and the picture, Profile Rock is a rock formation, maybe like a sort of cliff edge, that is said to resemble Wampanoag Chief Massasoit in particular. So it's actually in Freetown State Forest. It's not in the swamp, but it ties into the history I already talked about. So I did just sneak it in there with the other rocks in talking about the swamp. Interestingly, Profile Rock was damaged really seriously in 2019, and people are encouraged to avoid the area now because a chunk of the rock broke off and more could detach at any time, and they don't want injuries. So, sort of dorky. But I think it's so cool because this rock really looks like someone's profile. And I don't believe in coincidences, but I do believe in signs. So I think that's really interesting and absolutely understand that the Native Americans viewed that as some sort of sign or image from a higher power. So up next is the Solitude Stone. And hoo boy, there's a lot going on here. So again, super basic rundown on it because it is a lot. And there's a picture of that as well, which you can't really read the writing on that. It's hard to find a picture where you could read the writing. So this was also known as Minister's Rock, The Solitude Stone is found in the East Bridgewater portion of the Hockomock Swamp. There is an inscription on the Solitude Stone that was carved there by Reverend Timothy Otis Payne sometime in the 1860s, likely 1862 based on the date carved in it in Roman numerals. So the inscription on it reads, "All ye who in future days walk by Nunkatesset stream, love not him who hummed his lay, cheerful to the parting beam, but the beauty that he wooed in this quiet solitude." It's like a whole lot of words. So I was an English major and I love a good line by line poetry analysis, but we don't have time for that. And I'm also not going to subject you guys to that because I feel like people don't always want to listen to an in-depth poetic analysis.
I'm out of high school. I'm good. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, this isn't AP Lit. I'm not going to make you guys analyze a poem. I also had trouble finding sources that interpreted the language. So I kind of went off of my own here and interpreted this in my own opinion. So this is not based on anyone else's research. This is based on literally the text in front of me and the background I know about the area. So in the most basic sense, I took it to mean something about future people who are in the area being peaceful and quiet instead of like boisterous and loud. And not necessarily those in a literal sense, but like respecting the land, not changing it, that sort of thing. I could be wrong. That's how I see it.
I feel like that sounds and seems pretty accurate.
Yeah, it just quite literally sounds like, don't like the guy who's loud, mm-hmm. like the guy who's quiet and respectful. And, you know, lets the forest and the swamp live in its solitude. You know, let it be nature. Sort of leave it alone. Anyway, what's most notable about the Solitude Stone is that it is also sometimes called the Suicide Stone. When it was first uncovered from years of moss overgrowth, it was allegedly next to a missing person's deceased body. I could not find any info on this person, no matter how hard I tried, so maybe Rachel or Christine will cover it when they cover murders and cults and whatnot, and I'll be like, oh yeah, that's the guy. But for now, take it with a grain of salt, because it's one of those things that, like, every single article covering it that I found had, like, very similar language about, like, mm-hmm. and there was a body in the mossy undergrowth, and it was like,
that's it.
And are you taking this all from the same source? Because I'm not finding any reliable sources on this.
Right. Nothing about it said the general time period of when it was uncovered?
No, not even a time period. Because I'm thinking, oh, if you give me, like, a name, I can look up, like, missing people or missing people who were then found and identified. Nothing.
Where is Solitude Stone?
It's in East Bridgewater.
Okay.
And it's in...
It's in the swamp.
Okay, this is in the swamp. Okay.
Yeah. So I still think it's interesting. I found one particular account of someone who spent a whole day looking for it. And when she finally found it, it was, like, after dark. And she was, like, so spooked. And she had to go back the next day when she, like, knew where she was looking because it was so, like, spooky being there at night. And I don't blame her. I would not want to be in the Hockomock Swamp or the Freetown State Forest or, frankly, anywhere in the Bridgewater Triangle after dark by myself in the woods.
So, to be honest, like, not in the woods alone ever, in any woods.
Yeah. Yeah, especially, like, there's no established path through, like, this area. Like, she was like, yeah, there's no path. I was just, like, kind of, like, meandering my way around looking for, like, I knew vaguely where the rock was based on, like, other people's reports. I was like, nope, wouldn't ever catch me doing that, but have fun.
Yep.
I'm happy for you. It's still interesting. I wish people still carved stuff on rocks and then just, like, left them places very mysteriously. Because I think that's kind of, like, fun. Like, leave a little mystery, and then we're however many centuries down the line, we're sitting here like, what the heck does that mean? And what is it for? And it's like, you know what? We'll never know. I love it. I love a good mystery.
We should go carve something on a rock.
We should carve something on a rock and leave it somewhere, and so that people can find it in 200 years and be like, what does this mean? And all it says is, yeet.
Oh my god.
We gotta use like 21st century like slang or something. Like, this is bussin'. And people be like, what does this mean? I'm giddy with the idea.
But make it like a poetry.
Yeah, like rewrite like
with all of the like,
buzzwords.
Yeah.
I'll work on it. So I'm just thinking about this now and it'd be so funny. Perhaps the most interesting of the very interesting rocks in Hockmock Swamp, we have Dighton Rock, which unsurprisingly is actually not in Dighton. Yeah. Oh. So I know because okay. I was like, well, obviously I can just like write like, yeah, it's located in Dighton. It's not.
Is Dighton even in? That's not in the Triangle, right? Is
so it? It's included in everything I researched on the Triangle.
Oh, yeah, it is. Okay. It's yeah. like, right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
I want to know why we have a habit of naming things where it has nothing to do with, like, for example, like the witch trials. Like, why?
Was yeah. it originally in Dighton?
Yes.
Okay. So
what I was getting to.
Got ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, sorry. No, so it's located in present-day Berkeley, which used to be a part of Dighton.
Okay.
When it was first discovered, it was part of Dighton, which, gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Dighton Rock. Now it's present-day Berkeley, and actually it's not there either because it's in a museum.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fair.
It is it's in Massachusetts still. I'm not sure if the museum's in the Triangle, but it is, it's still local. But you can see on the picture I have on the drive, once again, not a great picture, really hard to come by. There are some inscriptions on there that are confusing. And you know me, I love a good rock inscription. So it's actually not a rock. It's a 40-pound boulder. And I'm thinking about SpongeBob. It's not a boulder. It's a rock. A rock.
What's the difference between a boulder and a rock?
Because I think know. A boulder is just very large. Like, I think it's once it is hits like, it? A certain amount of weight, I think.
That sounds fine to me.
Are you looking it up?
I'll look it up. Here it is.
Size and detachment.
A boulder is a type of rock, specifically a large detached one. Oh, wait, here we go with the square rectangle. All boulders are rocks, but not all rocks are boulders. Oh, yep. I love it. Anyway, that made me unreasonably happy. So anyway, it's a boulder, which means it's detached and large. And it has a number of inscriptions, specifically petroglyphs, which contain writing, lines, geometric shapes, and drawings that may or may not be drawings of people. It's super vague, I know. But there's a lot of mystery surrounding this rock and, boulder, big old boulder. And luckily, Dighton Rock is inside of a museum now, so it cannot be damaged or vandalized easily. So hopefully there'll be people studying this going forward. This was inspected and analyzed pretty seriously and pretty intensely around the time of the Salem Witch Trials by Cotton Mather himself, who, if you're familiar with the Salem Witch Trials, was a big figure in those trials. Opinions on him aside, he did do research into Dighton Rock. And a lot of other people throughout the early years of European settlement in Massachusetts made drawings of the inscriptions so that they could be studied. But a lot of the drawings are actually debunked for not being actually accurate to what the rock is inscribed with. So Reverend John Danforth's drawing of the rock is actually in the British Museum, but it's considered completely incorrect. Because the actual rock inscriptions are completely different, and it's not considered a reliable source for determining what the inscriptions mean. So I thought that was interesting that all these people have analyzed it, but they've analyzed it based off of other people's drawings of the rock, not necessarily what the rock actually says.
That just sounds like a game of telephone.
Yeah. So there's a lot of theories about where the writing came from and what it means, but just keep in mind that a lot of these theories have since been debunked because they were formed using other people's drawings of the rock that were then proven to be inaccurate transcriptions. So the first theory is it was the Native American people. It's the Occam's razor answer. I think it makes a heck of a lot of sense. Similar rocks with similar engravings were found in other New England states, including Vermont, so it could just be some form of glyphic writing in a language not known to modern scholars. And I don't think that's very far-fetched at all. Another theory is that it was the ancient Phoenicians, coming from what is now Lebanon. And you'll note that some of these theories are significant because they indicate settlers coming to Massachusetts well before the Pilgrims did. So that's just significant to note. Ezra Stiles proposed this theory in a 1793 sermon, but there's not really anything else to back it up. He just kind of said it. Number three, it was the Norse. So Carl Christian Raffin proposed a theory in 1837 that the Norse people landed on the shores of Massachusetts a long time before the Pilgrims did. And this theory was disproved by a bunch of archaeologists, including Kenneth Fetter and T.D. Kendrick. So that one is out. But for a while, that was the more popular theory. It was the Chinese. This is an interesting one. The theory was proposed by Gavin Menzies in a 2002 book. His theory is actually considered, like, pseudo-history. So it's almost certainly not correct, but it's really interesting to think about the Chinese landing on American shores in the 1400s. So like a full 200 plus years before the English settlers. And like I said, it's considered pseudo-history. It's completely been debunked and there's no evidence to back it up, but it is really interesting to think that that could have happened.
I feel like they would have heard about that.
Yeah, I feel like there would be more evidence to back it up if it was legit.
And there's because it is a good climate for settling, so I feel like if they did find it, they would have taken advantage of it. Like, whoever did find it, you know?
Right. Yeah. I like to think that any settlers who came from the East, or even the Western part of the East, from, like, Europe, would act exactly how the English settlers did. They would probably take land in a similar way, and there would have been conflicts that would have been recorded and known about.
Right.
In the 1400s, and there's no record of any of that.
Yeah.
So probably not anything that's legit.
Another thing too is, sorry, if it was Chinese, I feel like the inscriptions would kind of resemble like old Chinese language, and modern scholars would be able to determine that. I feel like it would stand out.
Yeah, and you'll notice on the picture of the rock that I included that that's not one of the theories that's included in like the museum display, because like it's
Yeah, it seems like, kind of a little far there.
Yeah. So I think this is the most interesting theory, that it was the Portuguese. So in 1912, Edmund B. Delabar proposed a theory that the inscription was a rough Latin translation of Portuguese words, translating approximately to I, Miguel Corte Real, 1511. In this place, by the will of God, I became a chief of the Indians. So, interesting, because it would show not conflict, but I can't think of the word.
Like, assimilating?
Yeah, exactly, assimilating. They didn't fight. They simply joined the tribes.
Do we have any indication that this person is even real?
Yes. So, this was thoroughly debunked in 2017 by a researcher whose last name was Hunter, and then I couldn't find his first name. But he explained in detail that the supposed Portuguese writing was based off of one of the unreliable transcription translations.
Okay.
So as compelling a story it would be to have writing from a real person, an acknowledged real person, which I'll get to in a second, he was real, with a date that matches with what people know of when he disappeared in the area, it's compelling, but it's probably not legit. But Miguel Corte Real was a Portuguese explorer, and he was believed to have disappeared around 1502 while on an exploration to the Americas. And he also had, like, a brother. So he went missing, and his brother came down the shore from, like, the eastern side of Canada to, like, look for him. And supposedly never found him, but there was some idea that maybe he lived with the Native American tribes from 1502 to 1511, which would be the basis of the theory. And then in 1511, he inscribed this to say, like, Miguel Corte Real was here, basically. Which, like I said, very compelling theory, but not much to back it up. So, yeah, I really like this theory, even though it's not real. I think it's really interesting because we have the real name of this person who was real and at least intended to go to the Americas in the time frame described. So even though it's wishful thinking, it would be really cool to have a record of him making it to shore and assimilating into Native American culture. But like I said, it's been disproven. A false translation based on a false inscription. Just kind of disappointing because I do think it's very interesting. But what's interesting is that until it was disproven in 2017, this theory was used to explain why even very early Native Americans had light skin. So they thought the lineage had been mixed with European blood as early as the 1500s. And that's why when the European and English settlers came in the late 1600s, there'd already been 150 plus years of white European blood mixing with the Native American blood. It's just an interesting point. I don't know how much of that is verifiable in that the Native Americans that the colonists encountered had lighter skin than would be expected. But anyway, just an interesting aside there.
I have a theory. So like you said, you one day you want to do that inscription just to kind of fuck with somebody, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if it was aliens? And it's just, and now they're just like watching us trying to figure it out and laughing.
I've said this so many times to Rachel, and she did go see them live with me, so she has like listened to an extent. But you really need to listen to the last podcast on the left, because they always have aliens as an option. No matter how far-fetched it seems, they always make sure to include aliens as a possibility.
Well, I don't know. I could get behind this all being a huge simulation and just like we're one big video game and people are just having fun because life is horrible. But that's a discussion for another day. I
can't get into that.
That would be a real tangent. An existential tangent.
Hold on. If I wasn't a video game, I would want it to be like, well, I don't want to say Fortnite, but, like, that's what I play lately.
It's Sims. It's just Sims.
Well, Sims, but so much bad happens in The Sims, and it takes forever to do everything. And, yeah, in hindsight.
That's
it is
literally
more similar
life
to life.
Well, it's Sims. It's in, like, simulations.
I never that's put like, that together.
Are
holy
you kidding
shit,
me?
I feel stupid.
Rachel.
Oh, my God!
What?
I've been playing that game since I was, like, under 10. Like, forever.
How did you...
Guys.
Okay. Rachel learned something new today. Anyway, none of these theories are conclusively true. Most of them are disproven to various extents. But there's, like, a lot of mystery surrounding Dighton Rock. What language or glyphic language is on the rock? What does it say? What does it mean? Who put it there? And why? Because you always have to consider the why. Unfortunately, like a lot of bizarre things in the Bridgewater Triangle that we'll talk about in the coming weeks, we'll probably never know. So I want to establish that now as the ongoing theme for this series. We'll probably never know.
But we'll definitely give you our theories.
But we're definitely going to talk about it, and we're going to talk about the theories, and we're going to talk about which theories we like especially. So if anyone's asking, I like the Portuguese theory of Dighton Rock. Even though it's been disproven and it was based on a false translation, I like that. I think it's really interesting.
The thing is, I could actually see something like that happening. Because, again, I feel like those kind of cultures, I feel like, are more inclusive and more friendly. And we, Europeans, a little bit more off-standish.
The British.
So, like, yeah. So, like, I wouldn't be surprised.
Portugal is in Europe.
Yeah, it's in Europe.
And
do you understand what I'm trying to say? Like, I'm trying to, like...
I don't know. I think most...
I get what you're trying to say, but I'm also thinking that wasn't Portugal in, like, the big three countries that sent explorers, like, colonization?
Okay, so just was, completely like, get rid of all of that.
It was England, Spain, and Portugal. So, like, I just, as much as I want to believe that there would be, like, a different tenor to their arrival, I just don't think it's...
No, I really just think accurate. It's humans wanting lands, and like
greed.
Most humans in that situation are probably going to be violent in that time period.
Well, it's one of those things, it's kill or be killed.
I mean, or just steal land.
Yeah, when you're going into someone else's land, it's like, is it kill or be killed when you don't have any claim to the land that you're trying to take? Like, oh no, be killed. Like, yeah, you don't have any claim.
I'm sure, like you were saying too earlier on, like, they literally thought they were fighting the devil.
Right.
And that was probably started somewhere by someone. Or maybe it was just thought at that time. So they actually think that that's happening. Like,
right. It was a misconstruction of polytheistic belief systems that led them to believe that they were actually fighting the devil himself. So there's layers to it. Because, yeah, on the one hand, it's kill or be killed to survive and steal land. But on the other hand, they really thought they were doing, like, a holy war.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, I like to think that it would be possible to say that there would be European or even Asian settlers that came in the centuries leading up to the English colonists, but I just don't think it's feasible.
Like, from their own history.
From their own history, and also the fact that there would be no records of it, right. And assimilation instead of conflict seems a little far-fetched to me. So, as compelling as it is, and they get bonus points for including a real person, mm-hmm. that gave it an air of credibility. I mean, I can understand why that theory was prevalent up until 2017 when it was disproven, because that one definitely has, like, the most credibility of all the theories. Anyway.
Yeah.
The way history presents itself is never uncomplicated. So this was crazy. This was a really fun episode for me to research, because I'm kind of a history nerd. Like, it's one of those things that, like, I was gonna say it's one of those things that people might not know about me, but here we go with Rachel calling me out.
I know you pretty well, Kate.
You do. And I'm not
remember
gonna
how we all met. AP Euro,
which is why it's all the more fitting that I have all these theories about European settlers and stuff.
Shows you that I remember nothing from that class.
I was going to say, to be fair, it would technically be stuff that happened in America, but we did talk about colonialism a lot in AP Euro.
I don't know. I blocked out that portion of my life. Sorry.
I mean, it's been like 10 years. It's not like I remember any level of detail. I just remember the high points.
Right.
And I didn't do well on the AP exam, so.
Me either.
But what matters is that I have a true crime podcast now where I get to talk about all of it and pretend I know what I'm talking about, which is, once again, want to put a little coda in here where I just say grain of salt for everything I say in this episode, because, like I said, drew from one major book source and a whole bunch of other sources, but who knows?
Well, I think you just got to remember that these are local legends and folklore, and there's multiple theories and reasons why, so it's kind of like you just got to pick whatever you think feels right for you.
Right, and also want to just throw in the necessary addendum about folklore itself as a phenomenon, that folklore is passed down orally. It's oral legend, and it's not until it's finally written down that we have a record of it. So I think it was it Rachel earlier who said, like, it's a big game of telephone?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It literally is.
That's all of history, is a big game of telephone, because we have these oral histories that are passed down from generation to generation to generation, and who knows how they change over the course of those retellings until eventually someone writes it down. And that's the version that's considered the historically correct version. But, like, how accurate is that retelling at that point when it's 3 or 4 or more generations removed from when it actually happened?
Yeah. So, like, the human mind is not reliable. Like, the human memory is just not reliable.
Exactly.
So who knows?
Who knows what history we're actually telling?
Yeah, and from, like, depending on what side you were on, you're going to have a different view. Like, it's hard to have an unbiased view of something if you're on one side of it.
Exactly.
So, but, I mean, thankfully, we do have some methods that nowadays we can use to kind of discredit certain theories.
Right. There's some good verification. I wouldn't even say verification so much as discrediting. Like, it's more of a knockout at this point. It's like, well, we know it's not X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying it's probably A, it's you've got to knock out all your other options first. Yeah. But I do think this is all very important info that's going to back up a lot of you guys' cases and explorations that you guys did into other stuff in the Triangle. A lot of it has to do with especially King Philip's War. I know was a big theme throughout a lot of the mythos of the Bridgewater Triangle sort of starts there. So, yeah, I really liked researching this. I hope you guys also enjoyed this little dive into local history that is really interesting because it ends up being the history of our country in a way too.
Yeah. It's also like the history of like where we grew up. Thank you,
Kate. Right, it's the history of where we grew up. It's like you got to know the swamp. Most of southeastern Massachusetts is swampland, but
just one big swamp. Thinking
of Shrek right now.
Not all of it is haunted. Some of it just has like turtles and stuff.
Get out of the swamp.
What if there was a cryptid that was literally Shrek? That would be remarkable.
Oh, all right, so God. This is I have a new
whoever's
theory.
Covering cryptids. I hope you cover that.
We should, on The Rock, we should draw a picture of Shrek and give, like, a warning. And then people in the future will think there's a giant green ogre that just went around.
We could say, get out me swamp, but, like, run it through Google Translator from, like, English to Portuguese to Spanish to French.
We could also throw an
yeet thyself out of my swamp.
I was gonna say, we could throw an yeet.
Right. And so then you run it through a few different translations until it's like not decipherable and then write it.
I don't know if yeet is gonna translate to other languages.
So maybe we just have yeet and then whatever the translation is for the rest of it. I think we should do it. Yeah. I think it would be fun.
All right. TM.
TM. Yeah. Trademark it. Verbal trademark. Yeet thyself out of mind swamp. Trademark.
Well, thanks, Kate. That was really interesting. And it definitely puts things kind of in perspective for me, too, because a lot of that does relate to my research. So it, it does answer some of my questions.
That's good. That's what I was hoping I'd be able to sort of check off some boxes for you guys of like things that you were like, how much background do I need on this? You know, like how deeply do I need to go into the background on this to make my cases make sense? So I hope I was able to give some of that background that will contextualize a lot of what you guys are going to talk about for some more modern stuff. Awesome. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys have come up with. I've seen some snippets. I've seen some little tidbits. So I'm really excited to see
what kind of chaos. I have some wild stories. And the thing is, I haven't even looked on Reddit. I'm kind of scared because I think I would just a rabbit hole. I'd be down there for days.
It's going to be tons.
I know.
So tune in next week. We'll have our regular Tuesday episode and then also we'll have part two of our Bridgewater Triangle series. So keep tuning in. We've got four of them planned for this month. Our first special series, which is so exciting, and we hope you guys enjoy.
Happy spooky season!
Woo! Yes, happy October!
Woo!
Bye!
Bye!